Low 30s, gusty west winds up to 25 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night in the mid-20s, and Thursday mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 30s.
Ukraine has fired long-range U.S. ballistic missiles into Russia for the first time as fighting continues.
Russia's foreign secretary says this marks a new phase of the war and his country will react accordingly.
It's Tuesday, November 19th, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. First to Hong Kong, where sentences were handed out in a key national security trial.
It's dampened the city's pro-democracy movement.
That there is now an end date. I suppose you could say that is progress.
People in Gaza say Israel is using a new weapon against them.
Small drones that carry guns and target like snipers.
So the drones would come down and pick off civilians. Children. This was day after day after day.
Plus, TV personality Dr. Oz has been nominated to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Prosecutors in the criminal trial of President-elect Donald Trump asked for another delay to weigh the unprecedented nature of the case. As NPR's political reporter Jimena Bastillo reports, plans to sentence Trump are on hold.
In May, a jury convicted Trump of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records, but his sentencing has been postponed several times. Now, Manhattan prosecutors who brought the case are asking Judge Juan Merchan to pause the proceedings to give them time to argue whether it should be dismissed entirely. Merchan had previously paused Trump's sentencing in the case. Trump's lawyers are hoping to argue to dismiss the trial and charges because Trump won the election and because of a Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity. They say that a sitting president cannot be charged. In a court filing on Tuesday, DA Alvin Bragg asked for a new deadline of December 9th to make his case. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, New York.
One of the last remaining cabinet-level vacancies yet to be filled by the incoming Trump administration is for Treasury Secretary. And the views of the president-elect on tariffs is part of the equation. Cantor Fitzgerald CEO Howard Lutnick, who had expressed broader support for tariffs, is now Trump's nominee for Commerce Secretary. Billionaire investor Scott Bessent is another possible Treasury pick, though he's spoken more about using tariffs as a negotiating tool. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is under scrutiny from Congress. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports FEMA Director Deanne Criswell is spending the day on Capitol Hill defending the agency before two House committees.
Much of the testimony centered on a FEMA supervisor fired earlier this month for directing workers to skip over Florida houses with Trump campaign signs. New Jersey Republican Anthony Desposito of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee.
Reports of FEMA employees skipping homes based on political affiliation and support of President-elect Donald Trump is both shocking and absolutely disturbing.
The head of FEMA says new teams are visiting some 20 homes affected.
To ensure that they have had an opportunity to register for assistance. And we've provided refresher training to all of our staff in the field to remind them about the importance of serving all people.
Deanne Criswell denies the incident reflects a wider problem at FEMA. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
While chipmaker NVIDIA has been dominating the current space in terms of providing computer chips for artificial intelligence applications, there are indications some of the things that work well for the company in terms of graphic processors may work less well in terms of putting those AI products to work. Some experts say it's opening up the industry for rivals who think they can compete in selling so-called AI interference chips. Those chips play a different role, helping to work for some day-to-day running of AI tools at a lower cost. On Wall Street, the Dow fell 120 points today. You're listening to NPR. What's known as a bomb cyclone is bearing down on the Pacific Northwest, the term generally used by meteorologists to describe a rapidly intensifying weather system that can happen during powerful storms like one in Northern California and the Pacific Northwest this week. The Weather Prediction Center is warning residents to prepare for possible heavy rains lasting through Friday, with long plumes of moisture stretching far over the Pacific Ocean. The Northern Sierra Nevada officials say the storm could bring as much as 15 inches of snow and 75-mile-an-hour wind gusts. The victim in a mass rape trial in France made her closing argument today. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports she used her pulpit to denounce French society and call for change.
Gisèle Pelicot said it's time for France's macho, patriarchal society that trivializes rape to change. Pelicot's husband and 49 other men are on trial for raping and abusing her in her own home while she was unconscious over a period of 10 years. Pelicot's husband is the principal defendant. He drugged her and organized the sessions, which he advertised online. 71-year-old Pelicot has become a feminist icon in France by refusing to be ashamed and demanding the trial be open to the public and the media to raise awareness. She called it a trial of cowardice on the part of the men who took part in the rapes organized by her husband. Many of the men said they thought she was going along with the game. None of her abusers alerted the police. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Crude oil futures prices closed modestly higher today. Oil up about 23 cents a barrel to end the session at $69.39 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
It's 5:06. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork and their Kellyer branch, banking that fits a customer's sense of adventure, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device, member FDIC. You can watch the Twilight Holiday Parade on Chestnut Street in Virginia this Saturday at 5:15. Fireworks follow at about 6:15 on the shores of Silver Lake. There's more ahead from All Things Considered on KAXE.
On a Tuesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. For the first time, Ukraine has fired long-range U.S. ballistic missiles into Russia as part of heavy, ongoing fighting. Russia opposes their use and says this marks an escalation in the war. We're joined now by NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Juana.
So, Tom, what else can you tell us about Ukraine's use of these U.S. missiles?
Well, U.S. officials say Ukraine has fired seven long-range ballistic missiles known as ATACMS about 70 miles into southwest Russia. Russia's defense ministry says it shot down five of the missiles. The U.S. says two were shot down, and some of these missiles targeted a weapons depot, and the damage estimate is ongoing. Now, President Biden on Sunday gave Ukraine permission to use the ATACMS inside Russia, something Ukrainian officials and their supporters in the U.S. have been advocating for more than a year. But Biden had opposed this previously, fearing it could lead to even greater escalation of the war. But here's why Biden changed the policy. Russia brought in more than 12,000 North Korean troops into the Kursk area of Russia, where Ukrainian troops have seized some territory, and it's a tough fight. This could change things, Juana, at least in that area.
Tom, what have we heard from Russia? What's the response been?
Well, Russian Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov called it, quote, a new phase of the Western war against Russia. And he said, we will react accordingly, though he didn't say what that means. He also pointed out that Russia has lowered the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons. That means nuclear weapons could be used in the case of a conventional weapons attack on Russia, one that is, they say, a critical threat to sovereignty or its territorial integrity. Russia has been saying for some time that such long-range attacks would mean NATO is directly involved in the Ukraine war, indicating that Russia could hit NATO targets like, you know, stocks of weapons destined for Ukraine. But this change in Russian doctrine, there were basically before this three reasons for the use of nuclear weapons. If such weapons are used against Russia, if there's a threat to regime survival, or if its army is surrounded.
Okay, got it. What about Ukraine? What have we heard from Ukraine about these missiles?
Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has declined to confirm or deny the first use of these long-range American weapons. He only said that, listen, we now have them and we will use them. But Ukraine doesn't have a lot of these ATACMs, so I'm sure they'll be focused on hitting key targets, including, I'm told, hardened targets that Ukrainian drones have not been able to penetrate. And again, these missiles will help in the Kursk region against these North Korean and Russian forces, but overall, it's hard to see this really as a game changer. Russian forces are making some gains in the eastern part of Ukraine, and U.S. officials have privately said Ukrainian forces going into Russia's Kursk area really didn't, it helped with morale, but really didn't achieve anything strategically. The best that Ukraine can hope for is all this places them in a better negotiating position, something really the U.S. has said has been the goal really from the start of the war.
Tom, a question for you about politics here in the U.S. I wonder, is President-elect Trump going to change or even outright reverse some of President Biden's Ukraine policies?
Well, certainly Trump could reverse it, and those close to Trump have criticized allowing the use of these long-range missiles. They want to end the war, and Trump has said that. The Vice President-elect J.D. Vance has suggested freezing the front lines before negotiations, a move that could help Putin. Now he holds about 18% of Ukrainian territory.
NPR's Tom Bowman, thanks.
You're welcome.
In Hong Kong today, a court handed 45 pro-democracy activists sentences of up to 10 years in jail for conspiracy to commit subversion. It's a landmark national security trial that has dampened the city's once feisty pro-democracy movement. Laura Westbrook was at the court in Hong Kong and sent this report.
Outside court, a lone yellow umbrella, a symbol of Hong Kong's once vibrant pro-democracy movement, could be seen in the cluster as hundreds of people gathered to witness the culmination of the city's largest national security trial. Inside, the judge took around 10 minutes to read out the sentences, going by number rather than name. The harshest sentence of 10 years went to former law professor Benny Tai. He was named as the principal organizer of an unofficial primary vote that took place in July of 2020 to pick candidates for planned elections. Prosecutors accused the activists of plotting to undermine the government by aiming to win a majority in the Legislative Council and use it to block budgets. The defendants included 28-year-old Joshua Wong, who a decade ago became the figurehead of Hong Kong's democracy movement. He was sentenced to 4 years and 6 months. Journalist turned lawmaker Claudia Mo was sentenced to 4 years and 2 months in jail. Her husband, Philip Bowring, was at court. He spoke to me after hearing his wife's fate.
The significance to the family is the fact that she's already been in jail for nearly 4 years. So, you know, in the sense that there is now an end date, I suppose you could say that is progress.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Lin Jiang told reporters that no one can engage in illegal activities in the name of democracy. Beijing imposed the national security law in 2020 in the wake of massive anti-government protests a year earlier. Authorities say it's been necessary to restore order and stability in the city, and residents' freedoms are guaranteed. But with today's mass sentencing, many here see this as a clear sign from Beijing that dissent is no longer tolerated. For NPR News, I'm Laura Westbrook in Hong Kong.
What would make someone go out of their way to talk with people they disagree with? That is one of the questions that came up as NPR reported our series Seeking Common Ground. We sent reporters all around the country to find people talking about their differences. We followed one group in Washington State where Democrats, Republicans, and independents open up about the issues. Lauren Gallup of Northwest Public Broadcasting reports on why they do it.
It's just before 9:30 in the morning. People are filing into the Port Angeles Senior and Community Center. Democrats, Republicans, and people in between all sit around the table together. Their discussions can get a little heated. At one point, the group is discussing what happened on January 6th, almost 4 years ago. Regular attendee David Fox, a Democrat, says he doubts that former President Donald Trump offered to secure the Capitol.
And nobody in the military remembers that conversation. That's the main thing. So that's all we got to go on that.
Sandy Lytle, a Republican, argues back.
And you're Nancy Pelosi, and that's your department, and you know this event is getting ready to happen. I mean, wouldn't you, in your common sense, say, we're going to need more than what we've got here today?
You wouldn't know it from this, but Lytle and Fox have actually become friends. I talked to them at a small cafe last month after one of their meetings. Both Fox, a Democrat, and Lytle, a Republican, just started going to the meetings this year. Neither of them is afraid to point out their differences.
I am a conservative Republican. I'm not hardcore, but I am very conservative, just probably more traditional. And these are my friends, these Democrats on the other side of the table.
They like that the discussion group creates a place to be open and talk about their differences. It's what keeps them coming back.
I think that's the big draw for me. It really is, just to be face to face with other people's ideas. And we don't hold back.
The group has been around since at least the 1990s. It's mostly been Democrats who go. And last year, worried they'd become an echo chamber, they reached out to the county's Republican Party office. That's how Lytle, who's president of a Republican women's group, joined. Coming from a family that always talked politics, she doesn't mind being outnumbered.
I'm always in hot water, always in the hot seat. So I say I'm just sharpening my tools.
It's mostly retired folks. Most of them are white, like Fox. Lytle is black. The meetings happen once a week. People bring clippings from media outlets across the spectrum, from The Guardian to The Epoch Times. They're allowed to bring up whatever issues or current events they'd like. Fox says the dynamics of the group are something he doesn't find anywhere else.
You read the news and you're not interacting. You watch TV and you're not interacting. You talk to your friends, and a lot of them, they might already agree with me on many ideas.
Fox says he appreciates that back and forth, and so does Lytle. But this month's election has been a test. I called Fox, and he said the day after the election, he felt enraged with Trump voters.
The first day, I felt like telling those people, I'm so mad at you, I wish you'd go away. I don't want to see you. I don't want to look at you. But that's not going to help.
Democrats in the group said in the first meeting after the vote, the discussion was painful, and some of the Republicans gloated. Lytle says she tried to avoid that and wants to move on past the election.
We still need to keep talking, and we still need to keep discussing the issues that are on our hearts.
And Fox wants to keep talking.
Whatever happens, whatever difficulties confront us, what's most important to me is that we don't go further and further away from each other.
He says they've learned to accept each other on their own terms. The group plans to keep going. For NPR in Port Angeles, Washington, I'm Lauren Gallup.
Tomorrow in the series, we'll take a look at what happens in the brain when we disagree.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, it is the Up North Report, local news from our region. Programming is supported in part by the Pickett Agency, an official Minsure partner. It's open enrollment season, and Pickett Agency is here to support the Bemidji community with health plan enrollment and guidance. More information by calling 218-751-1213 or by visiting pickettagency.com. We have a slight chance for some snow or mixed precipitation overnight, lows in the mid to upper 20s, and about a 40% chance of snow tomorrow, accumulations less than 1 inch, highs in the low 30s, gusty west winds up to 25 miles per hour. Snow flurries may continue into the evening, lows in the mid 20s, and for Thursday, mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 30s, breezy northwest winds 15 to 25. We receive support from Dragonfly Coffee in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment, special order pricing, and more at drinkdragonfly.com. We also thank the Minnesota Historical Society, presenting holiday sleigh rides at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, featuring a horse-drawn sleigh ride through the North Woods to make holiday memories in the great outdoors. Private group reservations available upon request. More information at mnhs.info/forestholiday. Curl Masabi in Eveleth hosts Burger Night this Friday. Social hour begins at 5:30. Curling instruction begins at 6:30. Carry in clean athletic shoes and wear comfortable pants and a light jacket. The Beltrami County Historical Society welcomes the First City Singers this Thursday at noon. The group will perform and share stories about their organization. We continue with All Things Considered on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Last week, British surgeon Nizam Mahmood testified in front of a committee in the UK Parliament.
What I think I found particularly disturbing.
Dr. Mahmood had recently returned from working at a hospital in central Gaza, and he told parliamentary members what he witnessed, including...
A bomb would drop maybe on a crowded, tented area, and then the drones would come down and...
A new kind of drone in the Israeli arsenal, one with a gun and a camera attached that can shoot remotely.
So the drones would come down and pick off civilians, children. And we had description after description. This is not, you know, an occasional thing. This was day after day after day.
For months, NPR has been collecting eyewitness accounts from Gaza that corroborate Dr. Mahmood's testimony, saying the Israeli military has been using sniper drone technology and that they are shooting civilians. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, and a warning, this piece includes the sound of gunfire.
37-year-old Fatma Adama is a freelance journalist from Jabalia in northern Gaza. It's an area that has been besieged by Israeli forces since early October. Adama sent NPR voice notes from her home there on October 9th. Hi, how are you? She starts. Israeli tanks are closing in, she says, and the army is nearby. Suddenly, she's interrupted. Ah, hear that? She says. That's the quadcopter. It's what many in Gaza call the small hovering drone with a rifle mounted underneath. If I try to go closer to the door to get better service, she says, the quadcopter starts shooting and I have to go back inside. It's very dangerous. The whole town is under siege by the shooting quadcopter drones, she says. No one can move. For months, NPR has collected accounts from more than a dozen people in Gaza who say they've seen these sniper drones and that they've seen them used to shoot and sometimes kill civilians. 55-year-old Adib Shakfa says he was walking with his 32-year-old son on May 31st in Rafah, in southern Gaza. Shakfa says it was a quiet day, there was no fighting nearby, when suddenly a drone appeared and shot his son, who was walking up ahead. He says two men rushed in to help his son, and they were also shot. Two older women nearby were also shot in the head, he says. Shakfa says the women were killed. So was his son. The Israeli military told NPR it's unaware of this incident and that any suggestion that it intends to harm civilians is, quote, unfounded and baseless. NPR also asked the Israeli military repeatedly if it was using the sniper drone technology in Gaza. It did not respond to the question.
Israel, frankly, like many militaries, is very cautious about what kinds of information it provides about its operations and tactics that it uses.
Seth Jones is president of the Defense and Security Department at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
But also makes it more difficult for everyday Israelis or journalists or other researchers to understand how these things are being used.
Further complicating that understanding, until recently, Israel had a censorship law in place forbidding the media from reporting on armed drone use by the military. And it's something most journalists can't witness with their own eyes. Israel has not allowed outside journalists independent access to Gaza since the war began more than a year ago. But we do know that this sniper drone technology exists and that the Israeli military has it. This is a video from 2018 by Duke Robotics Incorporated.
Duke Robotics presents...
for a small drone they call...
TCAD.
TCAD.
The future soldier.
Which can be outfitted with several different firearms.
Robots are replacing combat soldiers.
And shoot while it hovers, adjusting for the recoil of the weapon.
The company is in the process of implementing orders from Israeli forces.
Duke Robotics is based in Florida, in the U.S., but was established by veterans of several Israeli Special Forces units. Around that same time, Israel's Defense Ministry released a video showing off new technology, including... soldiers controlling one of Duke's sniper drones remotely and firing at targets at an outdoor shooting range. Then in 2021, Duke Robotics joined with an Israeli company, Elbit Systems, specifically to further develop the TCAD drone and market it globally. And there are other sniper drones on the market too, also by Israeli companies. In 2022, a company called Smart Shooter, based in northern Israel, announced a drone called Smash Dragon. In this YouTube video posted by the company, a small drone with a rifle barrel attached takes flight. The video then zooms in through the viewfinder to show the drone locking in on a human-shaped target before taking a shot. Smart Shooter denies that their Smash Dragon drone is being used by the Israeli military, but Israeli forces have touted using their technology in the past, and other products by the company are partially funded by Israel's Defense Ministry Research and Development. On Smart Shooter's website, it says it uses artificial intelligence and machine learning technology to provide, quote, one-shot, one-hit precision.
I would argue we're reaching a point where there are increasingly diminished human oversight over the practice of killing in war and also the decision-making process around who lives or dies.
James Rogers is an expert on drone warfare and emerging technologies at Cornell University. He points out that precision can be good, but...
no matter how precise your weapon systems are, if your intelligence is wrong, then all that precision, that guaranteed destruction of the target means is the guaranteed death of the wrong person.
The gunshot of the quadcopter has a special sound,
Dr. Ahmed Mograbi is a head surgeon at Nasser Hospital in central Gaza. He says he's treated many people shot by the sniper quadcopter drone.
They used to shoot at the displaced people inside the hospital, and they killed many people, actually.
Back in early February, Nasser Hospital was a focus of the Israeli military, saying Hamas fighters were hiding there. On February 1st, Dr. Mograbi says he and his coworker, a male nurse, stepped out onto a balcony after finishing a long surgery.
The quadcopter actually shooted my nurse friend beside me.
A drone shot the nurse in the chest.
They shooted at us.
Dr. Mograbi sent us a video he filmed that day. Colleagues rushed the nurse into an operating room as blood blooms around a bullet wound on his right chest. Quickly, Dr. Mograbi says, as others cut away the nurse's clothing to operate. The nurse survived. The Israeli military told NPR it was unaware of this incident as well. Here are just a few of the other stories we heard. Several people we talked to in Beit Lehia, in the north, described sniper drones recently shooting at civilians as they rushed to help pull people from the rubble after an Israeli airstrike leveled a building full of families. One man said a sniper drone entered his house with his family inside, started shooting, forcing them to flee. One doctor from the UK described sniper drones firing on people as they tried to enter a hospital in Gaza City where he was working. He told NPR he saw more than 20 injuries in one day from the drones, including one child shot in the neck who later died. Although there's been very little reporting on these drones, people in Gaza talk about them a lot. Most people we talked to brought up these attacks offhandedly. Sniper drones seem to have become so common in the war. And as Seth Jones points out, once technology exists, it rarely goes away.
The reality is this is an evolution in the character of war. So I don't think we're going to turn around and go the other direction.
This might very well be the future of warfare. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Good evening, it's 529. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find more local stories at KAXE.org. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital in Grand Rapids, offering rewarding careers in healthcare with open positions at granditasca.org/careers. Grand Itasca, where you're treated like family. Our lows tonight in the mid to upper 20s and a slight chance for snow.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. More than half a century after his death in Vietnam, a Talmon Marine's family will be presented with a Silver Star Award for Corporal Norris Brendan's actions that saved the lives of many fellow Marines. Sergeant Major Edward Neese served in the same company as Corporal Brendan during the conflict and shares on the KEXE morning show that Corporal Brendan was hit while providing cover for fellow Marines from a school building in Way City during the 1968 Tet Offensive.
Somebody ripped off a door off the hinges and they put a Marine on the door, and on the door was this Marine with a bandage on his head and had red hair. Now, the only Marine who had red hair in our platoon was Corporal Brendan. But I knew right away that Corporal Brendan had been hit. And we wouldn't find out till a couple of days later that he died en route to get medical treatment.
A Silver Star is the third highest military decoration for valor in combat, awarded primarily to members of the armed forces for gallantry in action against an enemy of the United States. The retired Sergeant Major Neese says Corporal Brendan should have received the award many years ago. VFW Post 1720 in Grand Rapids will host the award ceremony Wednesday afternoon. State Auditor Julie Blaha toured progress of Mesabi Metallics' direct reduction grade iron ore pellet plant earlier this week. The 7 million metric ton per year plant in Nashwauk is projected to start commercial operations early in 2026. Direct reduction grade iron is more cost effective for use in electric furnaces, where most modern steelmaking is moving away from coal-powered blast furnaces. In a release, Blaha says it is encouraging to see new life in the mining operation, crediting mining as a key to the state's economy. The multi-billion-dollar project is currently under construction on over 16,000 acres of land, and once completed, it will be the first new mine and pellet plant in the state in nearly 50 years. Edina Realty will pay a $3.5 million settlement after Attorney General Keith Ellison found the company breached its fiduciary duties with its clients. Ellison says in a news release that Edina Realty convinced customers to purchase home warranties from Home Security of America, a third party, and the company received payments from this third party without disclosing that information to its customers. As fiduciaries, real estate brokers are legally required to act in the best interests of their clients. Ellison says Edina allegedly violated that duty by secretly accepting payments from Home Security of America to push home warranties onto their clients. The AG's investigation alleges that Edina's conduct harmed Minnesota consumers by causing them to purchase HSA warranties that they otherwise would not have purchased, as well as violating Minnesota's Deceptive Trade Practices Act and Minnesota's Consumer Fraud Act. St. Louis County and the City of Aurora will present a preliminary layout for County State Aid Highway 100 this week. The two entities are planning a study of the 1.83-mile L-shaped segment, which is also known as 3rd Avenue North and Main Street. The study proposes the construction of a bridge that would eliminate a railroad crossing. Following the meeting scheduled for 6 p.m. Thursday at the Aurora Community Center, county engineers will move into the design phase of the project, which is slated for the 2026 construction season. State health officials are urging Minnesotans not to eat certain organic carrots due to a multi-state E. coli outbreak. Five Minnesotans became ill between September 21st and October 6th. One person has been hospitalized and no deaths have been reported. The Minnesota Department of Health linked the illnesses to eating organic carrots purchased from Costco, Target, and Hy-Vee, and brands have included Good & Gather, Bunny Love, and Cal Organic. Grimway Farms recalled multiple sizes and brands of bagged organic baby and whole carrots on November 16th. These products are likely no longer in stores, but may still be in people's homes and should be thrown away. That's it for the Up North Report from the KEXE News Desk. I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President-elect Donald Trump is hoping for another legal win today in his New York criminal trial. In May, Trump was found guilty on more than 30 felony counts of falsifying business records. But now that he's about to become president again, officials are dealing with an unprecedented legal situation, and a judge must decide what to do. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has been covering the case and is here to help us unpack all of this. Hey there.
Hey.
So, Jimena, can you just start by telling us what the status of this case was before today?
Well, as you mentioned, in May, Trump was found guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. This was decided by a 12-person jury, but he has yet to be sentenced. New York Judge Juan Merchan has already postponed the sentencing a couple times. His previous delay was specifically to wait for the election in an attempt to remove a perception of political bias. In court filings today, the Manhattan District Attorney said he wasn't opposed to a further stay of the sentencing while both sides make their arguments about whether or not the case should actually be completely dismissed. Trump's lawyers want it thrown out because Trump was elected to a second term in the White House and because of a Supreme Court ruling giving presidents immunity from prosecution of official acts in office. Trump's defense had argued the trial partly relied on evidence taken from Trump's first term and his time at the White House. But the Manhattan prosecutors on the case say that the jury's deliberations, which came before the July Supreme Court ruling, should be given weight.
Got it. Okay. Why have there been so many delays already?
As we've often been saying throughout this process, it is all very unprecedented. A former or sitting U.S. president had never before been tried and convicted of criminal charges. And now he's going to be president again. In the filings from earlier today, prosecutors pointed out that they are mindful of how Trump's upcoming inauguration date in January raises new legal questions. Ultimately, prosecutors acknowledged that there's no current law to decipher how a president can or not be prosecuted based on acts related outside of the presidency when they're about to be president again.
Interesting. Okay, and how does this case echo what's happened in Trump's other legal cases?
Trump has long said that this and other civil and criminal lawsuits were witch hunts against him. After Manhattan prosecutors asked for the delay in sentencing today, Trump campaign spokesperson Stephen Chung called it, quote, a total and definitive victory. Election results halted all the other criminal cases as well. Yesterday, the Georgia Court of Appeals canceled arguments in a criminal trial where Trump was charged with conspiring to manipulate the results of the 2020 election in the state. And special counsel counsel Jack Smith is also taking steps to wind down two federal cases against Trump, one related to the January 6th insurrection and another for allegedly keeping classified documents after he left office. Now, back to New York, legal experts point out that this is the criminal case that made it the furthest. None of the others even saw a trial. And they say that until Trump is sentenced, the case or the case is dismissed, this is considered an open case.
And Amanda, briefly, what are the options on the table for how this case could end?
Now, in the filings today, the DA seemed to suggest that he'd be open to putting a pin in proceedings until Trump is out of office after 2028. The Trump legal team wants this thrown out altogether, which means the jury verdict would also be dismissed. But again, these are unprecedented times, and it's hard to predict the exact outcome that we'll see.
NPR's Jimena Bustillo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Every week, a famous guest draws a card from our wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. The show's latest guest is Erykah Badu. She's a musician best known for her hit 90s album, Baduism, but her work extends way beyond her music. She's also an actor who can be seen in The Piano Lesson, that's streaming on Netflix this Friday, and she works as a doula, too. In her conversation with wild card host Rachel Martin, she talks about guiding new life into the world and guiding people at the end of their lives. Here's Rachel.
One, two, three.
Three.
Three. Well, I know the answer to this question.
No, you don't.
Okay. You're right. Do you think there's more to reality than we can see or touch?
No.
What?
See, you thought you knew the answer. Okay. Do I think there's more to reality than we can see or touch? Absolutely. Absolutely.
I know you work as a doula. You also sit with people who are at the end of their life. And in those spaces, it's hard to deny that there is more to reality than we can see or touch, because there's an energy there that we can't see or touch when life moves in and out of the world.
Yes. I mean, I don't know. And I don't have to know to want to be the welcoming committee as a doula.
Yeah.
You know, where they're coming from. I want to make sure that from what I've learned since I've been here, I just want to feel like your guide around the high school. And I'm a junior and you're a freshman. You know, and this is what I know about the school. It's what I want to share.
Yeah.
As a doula, specifically, I'm the welcoming committee. I want to make sure that when you come to this place, the room is prepared for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe if you have a start with easy breath, and love, and things you can smell that are beautiful, mm-hmm. and music that you can hear that's beautiful, and your parents united. And even though they have problems, they're taking this day to come together for this most important ceremony, the day you came into this world.
So if you're the welcome committee for the baby, when you sit with people who are at the end of their life.
I'm the ushering committee.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not going to profess that I know where they're going or by what kind of pathway or portal or vortice. I just want them to have the same experience going out. Easy breath.
Yeah.
Easy heart rate. I've left this realm or this place with something sweet to smell or to taste or to hear with love and relaxed. And I suggest that there should be no fear. Let's get to a point of no fear. Because you're going to know something that we don't know. But I believe that you're going to need your easy breath.
To hear more from that conversation with Erykah Badu, you can follow the Wild Card podcast.
Support for Wild Card with Rachel Martin comes from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Over the past decade, California has been one of the states most willing to embrace criminal justice reforms, but the outcome of this month's election is raising questions about whether voters are souring on some of these more progressive changes. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Marisa Lagos reports.
Jeff Reisig is the district attorney in California's Yolo County near Sacramento. He helped write Proposition 36, the ballot measure that overwhelmingly passed in California this month. The initiative increases criminal penalties for repeat thieves and drug users by rolling back portions of an earlier ballot measure, Proposition 47.
Prop 36 was a modest amendment to Prop 47. It wasn't a total repudiation of all of the reforms. Prop 47 went too far, and this kind of brings it back to the middle.
Reisig doesn't see this moment as a return to the tough-on-crime laws that dominated California politics for decades. He notes that Prop 36 will allow prosecutors to offer drug treatment as an alternative to jail time for drug users. It's not the argument law enforcement and conservative politicians made for years against reforms. In 2020, they failed to pass a much more draconian rollback of Prop 47 that focused solely on incarceration, not treatment. Yale Law School fellow Emily Bazelon says even in more conservative states, the public seems open to incremental changes to the justice system and to the idea that putting people in prison for long periods of time may not be the best way to improve public safety.
You have an alternative to incarceration program for vets passing in Nebraska, more parole eligibility in Mississippi.
Bazelon also notes that Colorado and Tennessee passed reforms this year, making it easier for people with felony records to get professional licenses for jobs, including construction work or cutting hair.
These are like relatively small bore changes. It doesn't mean that you're throwing open the prison doors.
Voters in California and across the nation are concerned about public safety, but they also seem skeptical of returning to the mass incarceration policies of the 1990s. That's according to Lenore Anderson, president of the Alliance for Safety and Justice, which pushes for criminal justice reform. She notes this year's California ballot measure campaign focused on getting people into drug treatment.
The proponents of the campaign talked about mass treatment. They talked about a balanced approach to public safety.
But in California, it wasn't just Prop 36. Progressive district attorneys in Los Angeles and Alameda counties lost their jobs in the recent election. Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco says there are some through lines between Prop 36's passage and those DA elections. Voters want accountability for people who break the law.
People are deeply frustrated when they go into their Walgreens or CVS and everything is locked up. They're frustrated when they see growing tent encampments on the street, and they want something to change.
Similar frustration has played out in Oregon, where a law recriminalizing drug possession recently took effect. But supporters say they hope the prospect of criminal charges will push people into treatment. It's the same bet supporters of Prop 36 are making in California, that the threat of jail or prison time will be enough to get people the help they need without a return to the harshest criminal sentencing policies of the past. For NPR News, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:48. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for your business, like smart bizd managed voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net. Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. And we thank the First National Bank of Coleraine. Since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More at coleraine.bank.com, member FDIC. Our weather for tonight, lows in the mid to upper 20s, slight chance for snow, and then about a 40% chance of snow tomorrow, accumulations less than 1 inch, highs in the low 30s, and gusty west winds up to 25 miles per hour. Snow flurries may continue into the evening, lows in the mid-20s, and for Thursday, mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 30s, and breezy northwest winds. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering opportunities in the tap room all season long for holiday shopping and gathering. Find out more about pop-up shops, rentals, events, and more on Facebook. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. We also thank North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information at northhomes.org. Hibbing High School presents a musical version of Freaky Friday, November 21st through the 23rd at the school's historic auditorium. Shows are 7 p.m. Thursday and Friday, 2 p.m. Saturday. Great Tales Animal Rescue presents Santa Paws, an opportunity to get photos of your pets with Santa, Saturday, November 23rd. There are separate times for dogs, cats, and other small pets at Central Squirmal in Grand Rapids. Find full details at greattailsanimalrescue.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President-elect Trump continues to announce his choices to join his new administration. Today, we learned his pick for Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, a billionaire investor and veteran Wall Street CEO. And we learned that he will nominate Dr. Mehmet Oz, known for the Dr. Oz show on daytime TV, to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin is here to tell us more. Hi.
Hi, Juana.
So, Selena, most people probably have heard of Dr. Oz, possibly even seen him on TV, but tell us, what's his professional background?
Well, he has a medical degree. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon. He also has a business degree from UPenn's Wharton School, like President-elect Trump. These are some impressive academic credentials, but Oz has built his fame and fortune by promoting alternative therapies like unproven diet products, cleanses, detoxes. He first became famous as a guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show. That led to a radio show and a daytime TV show, the Dr. Oz Show, like you mentioned. That ended in 2022 when Oz ran as the Republican candidate for Senate in Pennsylvania. He narrowly lost to John Fetterman in that race. If he's confirmed by the Senate, he'll be overseeing an enormous health agency that spends about $1.5 trillion a year. That is more than the Department of Defense.
And we're, of course, talking about the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Selena, tell us what's involved with running that huge agency.
Yeah, about 6,500 people work there, and the administrator has responsibility for several huge programs. The first is Medicare. That acts as an insurance provider to everyone in the country older than 65. It is an enormous operation. Then there's Medicaid. That's a health insurance program for low-income people that is run in partnership with states, and that covers nearly 80 million people. CMS gets to decide how states can manage their Medicaid programs. So do they help with social determinants of health? Do they require beneficiaries to look for work? The work requirements was something that was allowed in Arkansas during the previous Trump presidency until it was struck down in the courts. CMS also houses healthcare.gov. That's the place where people can go to buy insurance if they can't get it through their jobs. And Trump worked to undermine these Obamacare plans in his first term. Under Biden, enrollment has nearly doubled, and it's now around 21 million people.
Now, Selena, I know that Dr. Oz was criticized for promoting dubious medical and wellness products on his show. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. As far back as 2015, a number of Dr. Oz's fellow doctors at Columbia University sent an open letter to the school asking it to rescind his faculty position. He promoted things like green coffee bean extract for weight loss and other ideas with little or no scientific evidence backing them up. He was even called in to testify in Congress about his promotion of miracle products, and he faced a class action lawsuit about these claims, although the suit was later dismissed. He was also a frequent critic of public health measures during the height of the COVID pandemic and promoted unproven treatments for COVID as well.
Now, in his announcement, President-elect Trump said that Oz would take on the, quote, illness industrial complex, along with another one of his picks, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. What do you make of that?
Yeah, this is the idea that big food and big pharma are deliberately keeping Americans unhealthy for profit. Now, if these people are both confirmed by the Senate, Kennedy would be Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, so he would be Oz's boss. And these men have known each other for a long time. Kennedy and other vaccine denialists were guests on the Dr. Oz show. Now both men say they want to focus on healthy foods and keeping people well, which is, of course, a laudable goal. But so far, we haven't really heard many specifics on how they would accomplish it.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Filmmaker Ridley Scott reinvented the Hollywood sword and sandals epic 24 years ago with his Oscar-winning Best Picture, Gladiator. This week, he heads back to the Roman Colosseum with Gladiator 2. The film has already taken in roughly $100 million overseas, and critic Bob Mondello predicts it will do just as well here in the U.S.
After animated opening credits recap the first Gladiator film, a hero sold into slavery, fighting and dying in the arena, and at the last moment a boy named Lucius escaping in the chaos, the camera takes us to the coast of North Africa some 20 years later. There, a man played by Paul Mescal, who bears a striking resemblance to that boy, though he goes by another name, lives in a town that's being attacked by dozens of Roman warships. The battle, the first of many in an epic designed to emphasize sweep and grandeur, is furious and bloody, flames catapulted into sails, bodies hurling themselves at battlements, with more or less the expected result, articulated by Pedro Pascal's conquering general.
Reclaim this city for the glory of Rome!
At which point Mescal is sold into slavery and begins a journey remarkably like the one in the first movie. He's bought by a Machiavellian slave trader, played by a scenery-chewing Denzel Washington, who has big plans.
Rome must fall. I need to only give it a push.
The trader recognizes a hunger for vengeance in his gladiator and tries to stoke it.
Whose head could I give you that would satisfy this fury?
The entire Roman armies.
Too much.
The general will do.
The gladiator's taken to Rome, where that general's wife, Lucilla, from the imperial family, whispers of connections he's not ready to accept.
If you will not have your mother's love, then take your father's strength.
While he's exhibiting his arena skills, fighting everything from bloodthirsty baboons to a warrior astride a monstrous rhinoceros.
This is about survival! Come on!
Together and when it charges, break for the wall.
There is lots of fighting in Gladiator 2. It's kind of what we came for. And filmmaker Ridley Scott keeps it as varied as it is massive, even filling his Colosseum with shark-infested water for a naval battle. The film almost always looks spectacular, partly because much of it was shot not with computer effects, but with real crowds in a real Colosseum, a vision of ancient Rome to rival 1950s Hollywood epics. It often sounds like them, too.
There once was a time when honor meant something in Rome. In this Rome, I no longer believe that exists. We must find it.
It would be hard not to hear political echoes in some of this, often conflicting echoes. A hero plotting to topple the government to make Rome great again versus a newly empowered emperor who, when challenged,
Rome has so many subjects, she must feed them,
says impolitic things.
They can eat war.
And who is so sure the Senate will confirm his nominee for chief consul that he nominates his pet monkey. Accidental timing makes that one stand out, but there are lots more, readable in any number of ways. Or not. Gladiator 2 isn't nearly as much about the politics of Rome or even the inner life of its title character as it is about filling the biggest possible screen with echoes of the first film, from a double-sworded beheading to variations on the way a simple farmer touches grain and earth. A showcase for filmmaker Ridley Scott, who at 86 remains a master of spectacle and scale, and who knows the real question with this brand of popcorn picture is the one Maximus posed defiantly in the first Gladiator after dispatching an arena's worth of rivals.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?
It is, and we still are. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Information about the wonders of the universe is at templeton.org. From C3 AI, C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. From EBSCO, offering clinical decision support resources and tools, including disease and condition content from DynaMed and drug information from Merative. Learn more at DynaMedX.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9, and you may listen at KAXC.org or by asking your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also sample our album of the week. Coming up at 7, DJ Dang is your host for On the River. And we thank L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland.